all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio.
Good day. I'm Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today here on Veterans Radio, and thanks for joining us. We've got some interesting stories for you. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web, veteransradio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. And finally, PuroClean. PuroClean is the paramedics of property damage. It provides water damage remediation, flood water removal, fire and smoke damage remediation, mold removal, biohazard cleanup. It also has a focus on veteran franchisees. You can learn more about them by going to puroclean.com. We just want to remind you that Veterans Radio podcasts are available on all your favorite streaming platforms, including RSS.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Reeves Across America Radio. So wherever you are, you can find us, whether it's on your mobile phone or your computer or your laptop, your tablet. But listen in to Veterans Radio podcast. We post something new every week, and you're going to find it informative. It is an honor to welcome to Veterans Radio Medal of Honor recipient Colonel Paris Davis. Colonel, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, this is an interesting story. You have a book coming out called Every Weapon I Had, A Vietnam Vet's Long Road to the Medal of Honor. And as I mentioned earlier with you, we had the chance to talk to two guys. We'll talk about them a little later, Jim Moriarty and Neil Thorne. We did an interview with them as they were trying to get your package up and approved for the medal upgrade to the Medal of Honor. They were successful, and you are now carrying that heavy weight of wearing the Medal of Honor. But let's start back at home. Cleveland, Ohio boy. Your dad worked in a foundry. Your mom and dad had 9 kids.
That's correct.
You had some uncles who lived with you, and we're going to talk about one of the uncles, Uncle PD. Tell us a little bit about home life.
Well, I tell you, it was really quiet. It was very normal. It took on a tone of its own. And when I say that, I'm talking about, my mom would say, okay, I want you to go outside and get all the, rake the grass and cut the grass and so forth and so on. And if I didn't do it the way she wanted it, after giving me, I'm talking about instructions that were so small and so, so in her language that I always couldn't do what she wanted to say. Then she would give me a retrieve, and if I didn't get it that time, she said, just go get a switch.
Yeah, you talk about there was family discipline, both your mom and your dad, and there was chores and responsibilities. Everybody in the family had jobs to do around the house. It was pretty structured.
Well, it really was, and the thing about it, it didn't give you a lot of room to play with. When she says something, and you know, she was like Genghis Khan. I mean, you do it or you did. And so she had this thing about her. She would look you right in the eye and say, this needs to be done. Are there any questions, after she explained what she wanted done? And I would either say yes or no or whatever. And then she said, okay, go after it. And the same thing about your homework that you had to do when you were in school. All those things had a place on her table. And if I had homework to do, she and my dad would go to bed, I don't know, 9 or 10 o'clock. And I would have that homework on the table. When I came down for breakfast, she would either have part of it lined through, or would say okay, or change this or change that. And that's just the way it was. And when she told you to do it, you did it. And then she did the result.
Well, you know, learning, you know, responsibility, your place in the order, you know, that there are consequences if you don't do what you're supposed to do, kind of all good, valuable life lessons, weren't they?
Well, they really were. And the other thing is, she would say it the first time that she would ask you to do something, she had already done it once. So she knew exactly what she wanted. She would tell me how to do it, and then I did it. Now, that just really followed over to the military. I remember, I hope I told you, that way back when we were first operation, we had to go across a stream, and it was pretty deep, so forth and so on. And we had to tie off. I showed them the knot we wanted and everything else. When I got on the other side of the river, it seemed like they had more time than they needed to get this thing squared away. And so when I got on the other side, I said, hey, what the hell's going on here? And he said, well, we can't figure out the knot that you wanted. I said, that's bullshit. I already told you twice. And then I said, we either going to get this thing done, or when I come back, I have two graves for both of you. I said, there's no reason that you didn't pay attention. I said, it's really smart on my part to make sure you had all the information you needed, so you couldn't fuck it up.
So mom's lessons are ringing true right there. Her voice was in your head.
Well, I tell you, and the thing about it, if you didn't understand what she was saying to you, and you didn't ask the question, like, what do you really want, mom? And what am I doing wrong? And she would either tell you or something. She told you twice, she would just say, go out and get a switch, and then you knew you were gonna get your butt beat. So, I mean, she was just, and the thing about it, when you have a little piece of a branch or whatever it, and it was still sort of orange in color, you know, or dark orange, you know, it really had some zing to it when she hit you. And so the thing about it is, you wanted to try to make sure that when you did things like that, you did them correctly. To get back to what I was trying to say is, once you swim across the river, and they're still messing around with the knot. And you said, what the hell is going on here? And we can't decide on that. And then I said, you know what? This ain't going to work. Either you're going to leave here and talk to both of them, or I'm going to have to leave here. But one of us is going to be dead right where you are. Come back, and I'll be back in about 20 minutes. I have something else to do, and you better have it done.
So I should point out to folks that Colonel Davis, Army, Airborne, Rangers, Special Forces, Green Beret, he doesn't put up with crap. And some of that sounds like it may come from mom and dad, but things weren't all easy in the family growing up either. And really there was sort of a change of pace when your older brother, Barry, got himself in a bad situation. I think it was a burglary, ended up going to prison. I mean, that really cast a cloud over your growing up and the family's dealings after that, didn't it?
That's a great answer. And let me tell you why. We had an order in which you eat. You know, and kids were not first, they were last. Adults have worked, they had done their job, they were in a house that we really loved, and all those other kind of good things. So why couldn't you just play a little longer and let her cook a little less and let them eat first, and what was left was for you? And it always worked out. And no one really pissed and moaned about it. You know, and the other thing is, you need to have someone with the gavel. They can punch it on a piece of wood and say, okay, that's all. Next. You know, it was this thing that you want to keep thing at a level where everyone could enjoy. Because when you're in a house like that, you want to laugh and you want to do this and you want to do that. We had a little television that only it was black and white, and, you know, so, and that's the only colors you could get. And we enjoyed it. And the other thing is that you said two things. I love my God and I love my mom. And that just went everywhere. And, you know, my dad was included, and we just had a good time by doing it that way. And the reason why I went to so much detail, when you're in a situation like that, I can remember when we first got to our camp, the first night that we were there, I slept in the doorway. I wanted everyone on the team to know that if somebody was going to get killed, it was going to be me, because it had to come through me to get to them. And I tried to do that throughout. You give them an example, and you know that you've already done it, so they shouldn't have a problem about pissing and moaning and doing it. And you cut down on the noise, and increase the fact that you could say something. It was going to be done correctly, and then you could get going.
I want to talk about Uncle PD for a moment, because in reading your book, Every Weapon I Had, I got the sense that Uncle PD was kind of one of those guys who pointed you in a good direction. He helped you get into Southern University, but he was kind of a North Star, it sort of seemed to me. What was the relationship with Uncle PD?
Well, I was named after him. I did not know that for a long while. Because everybody called him PD, and my dad and brother John and Uncle Prince all called him, you know, PD, and the house was really big, and I think that was one of the reasons why everything went as well as it did, is because everyone had to contribute to the payment of the mortgage and so forth. And so I'm talking about my other three uncles that lived there. And so that really worked out very nicely. And when someone was sick, my mom was there. We called in the help that needed to be there, the doctor, whatever it might be. And it just worked out so that people could have their space in a crowded room.
And one of the things I think it was PD who kind of, and maybe it was your mom, really pointed to was the whole idea that reading... I know this sounds trite, right? Reading is fundamental. That reading and education was something that that they really wanted for you, Paris.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the other thing was, every day we would read a paragraph out of a paper or out of a book that we were supposed to know. So that she could be in there cooking and whatever, and she could hear the person reading, and the others would be in there listening. And sometimes she would make sure that I was in the middle, and one brother and her sister could be on each side. So all three of us were reading the same thing at the same time. And she would either tell me I did a good job or whatever. And sometimes she would have one of the other kids to read what I just finished, just to make sure that they understood the words that they were speaking and the meaning that they got from reading what I had just read.
We're spending a little time on this, Veteran Radio listeners, as we talk to Medal of Honor recipient Colonel Paris Davis, because you can go read, and we'll talk a little bit about the battle that earned him this distinction, but he's giving you now sort of the foundation, the bedrock of the man he became, the man he displayed in Vietnam. And along the way, the family kind of nudged you to college, and you ended up at Southern University in Baton Rouge, I believe. And again, that was sort of through some efforts of your uncle PD, who was kind of maybe guiding you with a hand.
You know, the, I'm glad you said that, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And he had a friend, and I want to say his name was Ernest or something like that, who was teaching at Southern University. And he called him, and it took him about 3 or 4 phone calls before he got to him and told him what he wanted to do. The person, Mr. Ernest, sent up an application and all the other kind of things that he needed to do, because he was an instructor down in at Southern University. And he was able to get me into the university. My grades were pretty good, and were really good. And he thought that I could really do well down there. And so he spent a lot of money. At that time, you know, if you wanted to make a phone call, you had to put the coins in the machine before you could get a voice. And so after we went somewhere, because our phone wasn't working, and he had all that change in his pocket, and he kept putting in quarters and nickels and dimes when the operator would say, "Your time's up," and we would just continue until we got all the things set up. And sure enough, he sent up the application, and they went down to Southern University, and he told me that I was over the goal line. He said something like that, and he said, You've done well, but I tell you, when you come here, I'm not going to let up on you. I've talked with your uncle, and he and I are friends and been friends. And he told me that he thinks you could do it down here. And I'm going to see if you can do it down here. And if you do, he's going to be really, really proud of you. But I tell you, the other thing is, you know this better than I do. Your mom has given him permission. If he sees you doing something wrong, he tells you a second time, you're going to get your butt whipped.
Mom knows how to keep you on the straight and narrow. It's important to stop on these things and sort of, you know, these today we use words like mentors, right?
Yeah.
Uncle PD, his friend down at Southern University, they were guiding you. They were mentors, outside the family, outside the mom-dad circle. And as you said, you didn't know where you wanted to go or go to college or what you were going to study. But a lot of life is sort of like, I don't know where I'm going, but somebody points me in the right direction. And you ended up getting involved with ROTC down at Southern University for the very practical reason most people do, is that they needed to pay for college. They needed a little spending money. But the ROTC little did you know at the time you joined, you were going to have this, what it was, 25-year career in the Army. Talk a little bit about how being in the ROTC shaped you.
This is so important to me that you ask that question, because even though Southern University was a black college, we had white instructors. Especially in ROTC, because the Army don't care what color you are. And so when I got there, I was waiting to be waited on, and this sergeant came up, and I didn't even know who he was. He said, "What are you doing?" Yeah, I said, "I'm waiting to be to see whether or not I'm accepted or not." He said, "If you have an application like that, you're accepted." He said, "Let me ask you a question. Do you want a job?" And I said, "I don't know. I haven't even signed in yet." He said, "You know what? One of these days, I hope you're going to graduate and you're going to need a job." And he stayed with me that whole time that I was at Southern University. And each time he would see me, he would tell me something about the Army and the way I needed to do it for civilians. And so, I mean, the thing about it, he would just, every once in a while, he would try to get my grades and everything else and tell me if I needed to work on math or geometry or whatever it was. He said, there's no reason why you have to be dumb. He said,
wow, there's a pretty direct statement, right? And again, you know, this larger issue of mentors, somebody helping you along the way, and you don't fight it. You take the advice and internalize it, and that's part of how you keep growing, isn't it?
Well, it really is. And the thing about it, you meet a person who sees you in line and comes up and you introduce himself, Sergeant Cook, so forth and so on. What are you doing here? Well, I'm trying to register. He said, that's going to be fine. But when you finish, will you need a job? And every time he would see me at the end of a semester, he said, you're doing fine, but when you finish, you're going to need a job. And doggone it, I was in the ROTC program. He told me first what it was about, and then taught me the things that I needed to know. Uniforms that you had to wear, so forth and so on. Times you had to be at class or this position or that place. And he kept me right on the nose. I mean, I was doing things. I wanted to be there 4 or 5 minutes or maybe sometimes longer than that, so that I didn't disappoint him. I was more afraid of disappointing him than I was in passing the class.
Well, again, those are valuable lessons. And this is the foundation, veteran radio listeners, of Medal of Honor recipient Colonel Paris Davis. This gives you a sense of his foundation, of the man that he was taking into the Army where he spent his professional career, you know, if you will, earned your way up to full colonel rank. But during that, you spent time in Vietnam in June of 1965 at Bong Son Dinh Binh province. You were in with small units training locals. This was really what Green Berets did. Tell us a little bit about what that work was for you at that time.
Well, the way it started was that I was in college, and President Kennedy had just won the nomination. And I wrote a letter to him. It was a short letter, and all I said is that I saw it in the paper, I heard it on the radio. I'd like to do what you're saying. And I didn't get a letter back. I finished my college and so forth and so on. I got a letter later on, just before I was ready to try to find a job. And it was from the Army. It said, you're going to be going to IOBC, Infantry Officer Basic Course, and we'll be sending you two things, a bus ticket to the station and an airplane ride to where we are. And I got both of them. And so it was a matter of him coming to me and said, this is the job I was talking about. He said, you can really, really do it well, or you can ham it up. If you ham it up, I never want to see you again. And the reason being, you ought to be smart enough to get this thing done the right way the first time. And so I got on the bus and went to the airport and was just scared to death because I'd never been to an airport and never been on a bus that size. And so I did both of them. And luckily, when I got to the airport, I got some help to go to the different place that the place I needed to go to get on the airplane, and they helped me there and so forth. And I had a note that my uncle had written, and it was enough. He said, just give this to the attendant and you'll be okay. And so I finally got to Southern University, and Mr. Ernest was there, and he picked me up, carried me to his house, and gave me a meal or something. He said, "We'll get you in school, and we'll see how this works out."
So you start as a guy who's never been on an airplane, and ultimately you qualify for Army Airborne with all the jumps, then Ranger School, then Special Forces, Green Beret. You kind of overcame all of those little firsts and fears, didn't you?
Right, and when I got to Fort Benning, I'm running, walking, and trying to figure out what the devil's going on. So I'm in the middle of nowhere, and this person comes up to me and he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm trying to find out where I go to make sure that I'm registered." And he said, "You're looking at a registration at me. Come on in here with me and don't say a damn thing unless I talk to you." And so I went in there with the sergeant, and he sat me down, and we talked a little bit about Cleveland and some other things. And he said, "Look, when you go in, you're in the military. You're going to be in the military, I hope, because we have to sign you up real quick because you're about to graduate. You're in the 11th grade, and you need to have this on your record so you can earn a little money, and we can learn you a little bit about the Army. And if we get both of those going together, you're going to be okay." And that's just what happened. And I saw him a couple of three times. The first time was he told me that I was out there wandering around, not knowing where the devil I was. And he pulled me aside. That's right. He pulled me aside. He said, "What are you doing out here?" I said, "I'm trying to figure out what I'm supposed to do." He said, "Come with me. You're going to airborne school."
And you said, "Okay."
I probably choked on it a couple of three times. But anyhow, he finally got me in there. And once he asked me for my telephone number, and I said, "This is my mom." And he said, "That's the person I want to speak to." And they had a conversation about me being at Southern University, and he was going to really look out for me. He knew I was there by myself, and he wanted to make sure that I could do all the things that the Army would help me, that would help me with, and that my mom would love me all the more if I did a good job. And that was the initial conversation I had with him. And then he said, "You know, there's one thing you don't know a lot about, and I'm going to give you a job doing that." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Cleaning up shit." he said, "You're going to go into that laboratory over there, and you're going to clean up all this shit that's not in the toilet."
Well, hey, there's a job for everybody, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to curse on your program.
Before we run out of too much time, I'm gonna skip over the June 1965 battle of Bunxon, where you your actions resulted in you ultimately earning the Medal of Honor. You also received the Silver Star, which got upgraded. You received a number of Purple Hearts because you got shot to pieces. You saved a number of your men's lives in combat. This fight took on this hill took about 24 hours, and it's estimated as many as 1,400 Viet Cong were dead at the end of this. The battlefield was just littered with them as they kept throwing waves after waves at you. I'm gonna skip this a little bit because anybody really interested in that story should read the book. Every Weapon I Had, but you can also find all kinds of reports about the battle, about Colonel Davis. I went back and looked at one you mentioned in the book because I could find it online, and I figured I could, and it's a March 1969 show with Phil Donahue, with you and fellow veteran Ron Diaz talking about Bobby Brown, Robert Dennis Brown, who was shot in the head during that battle and ultimately died in 1969. But that's a really good, you know, snippet explaining the battle, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on that.
Okay.
What I want to turn to, though, is your story is unique in that it took 50 years for you to get recognized for this. And fortunately, you're still kicking when it happened. Your package was your, and folks who don't know, you have to put in a very extensive package for a Medal of Honor to be considered. The individual, Colonel Davis didn't submit this. People submit this on his behalf. It started right after the battle with Major Cole, who submitted the package, and it got lost. And it got lost, I think, in 65, 69, 2013. Right. A whole bunch of times, you're not sitting around, you know, wringing your hands, hoping you get the package approved. You're just going on with life, and this is all this noise going on in the background. Explain this a little bit to folks who go, a 50-year journey, what the heck?
Let me start with, and this won't be very long, that the team I had was all white. They're just, because you had to be able to swim, and you had to be able to speak a language. And when I was in charge of the team there, I knew that my time was almost up, and I had been wounded a couple of times. And what happened there, Hubbard, who was my senior medic and also a cook, and he asked me to come there to some of the team wanted to speak with me. And what they said was, if you get wounded again, we're not going to put it in. If you get wounded after that, we're not going to put it in, because we want you to stay as our commander. And he said, if it's okay with you, I've talked with the whole team, and we're not going to put in all the times that you've been wounded or anything else, because if we get a third one in there, they're going to pull you and put you somewhere else. So if you don't mind, we're not going to say anything. So that happened. And the reason why that is so important is that when they started trying to figure out about the medal and all that, all these white soldiers took the time to write their parents and their people in the government to see what the devil happened. And they wouldn't let it go. When they would go home, they would always go to their congressman or whatever and get a reason why it hasn't moved, so forth and so on. And I think the reason why it finally will start moving is the fact that when you're that close with your team, they don't want you to leave, and they want you to do the best you can to get through this thing. And that's when they call their parents and other people to call your congressman, thus and so forth, so that we could see if we can get this thing done. And that was the part that I thought was Paris Davis knew about. And I'll tell you, when they first told me that, I had a tear or two.
You often find that these Medal of Honor recipients are not only just regular human beings who did extraordinary things, but also generally very humble guys. And it's a great honor to talk to Paris Davis. He has a new book out, Every Weapon I Had. I would encourage you to track it down, read it, and learn more about his stories. You can find them all over the place because it did take about 50 years to move this along. There's a great interview with him explaining the battle on a Phil Donahue show. You can find that on YouTube by a simple search. So do some more reading, do some more investigating. You're going to find this interesting and pass it on. This is history that should not be forgotten. And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook
and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows
by visiting us at veteransradio.org. That's veteransradio.org. We again want to thank our national sponsors, the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, Legal Help for Veterans, a veterans disability law firm and with a national practice before the VA, can help you on your claims and your appeals. It can be reached at legalhelpforveterans.com or 1-800-693-4800. And PuroClean, a leader in property emergency services. It's the paramedics of property damage, providing water damage remediation, flood water removal, fire and smoke damage remediation, mold and biohazard cleanups. You can reach them at puroclean.com or 800-775-7876. We also want to thank our local sponsors. This would include the Charles S. Kettles chapter of the Vietnam Veterans of America. That's chapter 310. VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423, the American Legion, Irwin Preskin Post 46 in Ann Arbor as well, the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System, and certainly the National Vietnam Veterans of America Association. You can be a sponsor by going to veteransradio.org, clicking on the About Us and our sponsors, and help us out. Keep this program alive for the 21 and 22 years. Keep us going for another 20. Thank you.